During this hour of the show, we will talk with Suzanne Troopin. She is a medical doctor, and she is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine here in Champaign-Urbana. She practices medicine, has her own clinic, and is good enough to join us once a month to take your questions on women's health issues. Normally this would be on a Monday, but since we weren't here yesterday, we're doing it today, and she was kind enough to come in. We'll talk about a few things, but if you have any questions, you're welcome to call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, if you have questions for Dr. Troopin, you can call us at 333-WILL, toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Troopin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, there are a few things we listed that we could talk about. I wanted to ask you about one thing I noticed in the newspaper. There was an article about drug safety in pregnancy that very little is really known. I don't know if this is, you know, typical media exaggeration or
maybe some exaggeration.
But you know,
I didn't see that particular article.
Well, the point of the article, at least one of the points, was that there are concerns about actually testing drugs on pregnant women because you might have some bad effects on the infant, but that it is an issue that perhaps people should be aware of.
Well, it's true. We don't run what we call randomized controlled clinical trials, which we do for everything else. We get most of our information based on what they call anecdotal reports, so that if a new drug comes out and a pregnant woman gets exposed to that drug, mostly inadvertently, then we ask that physicians who are aware of cases like that make those type of cases known to either the drug manufacturer or the Centers for Disease Control. And if all the reports coming in appear that the drug is safe, then it gets labeled safe. And if all the reports coming in have concerns, now it would be labeled as unsafe. Now, there are some drugs that have such dire consequences in animals that they get immediately labeled as what we call Category X. You should never give these in pregnancy. And most Category X's, like a couple of the blood pressure medicines, ACE inhibitors are Category X. Some of the acne treatment, the retinol derivatives are labeled as Category X. The anti-nausea medicine that caused phocomelia, where the limbs of the of infants were affected, thalidomide, it was labeled Category X, and then it was actually taken off the market because of that. But it was such an excellent drug that it started to be reintroduced into the market for certain indications, but it's Category X. But we don't have too many Category X type drugs where you absolutely must never use those in pregnancy. What we usually have are drugs labeled Category A, and those are considered completely safe, things like certain antibiotics, ampicillin, certain simple cold remedies, things like that get labeled as Category A just because so many pregnant women have taken them, and we've never seen any rate of abnormalities any different than the natural population abnormalities. But then most drugs get labeled in the middle, categories B, C, or D, and those categories are pretty much determined on these anecdotal reports, as I was saying earlier. And it is a concern, and it's an issue. How would you study the drug if you can't figure out a safe way to study it? It's not even considered worthy of approval study to, even if somebody was going to not continue her pregnancy, it's still not considered ethical to study the fetal effects of a particular drug. So it is a problem.
Okay. What about antidepressants?
Well, most of those have made it for either to Category B or C, and it's primarily, again, because patients have taken them safely in pregnancy. And then and further information usually has to do with when in pregnancy you take the drug. If you get if you take the time of conception up to about the first 12 to 14 weeks of pregnancy, so that gets you just beyond the first trimester. We refer to that as the quote-unquote fetal period, so most of the organ systems are being formed. So if you get beyond that, it's thought that those systems have already formed and your ability to cause an abnormality in an already formed organ system is probably less. So that if you can get beyond that, some physicians feel more comfortable adding in the drug after that point in time. And that's where a lot of the antidepressants sit. Is that one of the drugs they were talking about in the article?
Yeah, and there was a case, some tragedy that happened because a woman was told that she couldn't take her antidepressant medication, that it would leach into breast milk and harm the child, so she stopped taking it and ran into trouble. So.
Yeah. We had a lot of cases like this with the seizure medications. It's been known that certain high dose levels of certain seizure medications are associated with certain types of birth defects. So back in the 70s, when I did my residency program, and I actually was involved in writing a paper on this issue, women were taken off their seizure medications in hopes that the babies would not be malformed. But in fact, what would happen is they would have more seizures, and the seizures themselves would affect the development of the pregnancy or the health of the pregnancy. So not only was the mom now at risk from suffering consequences of seizure, but actually when you were trying to protect the baby, it may not protect the baby at all, because if a mother's having a seizure and she's not getting oxygen, no oxygen's going to the baby either. So that was an issue that they had to work out. And luckily, we've been able to develop certain safer alternatives for seizure treatments in pregnancy in the past 20 years. But that's a similar kind of situation where you think you're doing the right thing for both the mother and the fetus that's developing, but you may not be.
Well, that was my one question. So people listening, if you'd like to join us, you can ask your own. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455 if you have questions related to women's health issues for Dr. Suzanne Troopin. You mentioned there's a new IUD out.
There is. As you may know, or as our listeners may know, the intrauterine device is nicknamed the IUD for the initials that it stands for. And it's a contraception device that is usually placed inside the uterus to allow it to remain there for a certain period of time. Really the only IUD available. There's a one progesterone IUD available now, but the only IUD available that most women know about is a copper T called Paragard. And it is essentially a plastic device that looks like a small T. It's about an inch in size in both directions of both arms of the T, and those arms have some copper wire wound around them, and that IUD is placed inside the uterus, usually at the time of the menstrual period, and can sit there for 10 years and provide contraceptive effect over that 10-year period of time. Now, the IUDs are thought to be extremely safe, but there were still question marks in patients' minds because of the information back again in the 50s, 60s, and 70s when there were different kinds of IUD, and particularly one that was of concern was called the Dalcon Shield. And the Dalcon Shield was an excellent IUD in that it was very, very effective. And it had a funny fish shape size to it that allowed it to be so well suited for sitting inside the uterus, it was virtually never expelled. So it was very effective because it just sat there. Unfortunately, the shape made it difficult to remove. And because it was difficult to remove, the manufacturers of that IUD developed a braided kind of string. And it was thought that because the string to remove the IUD was braided, that bacteria could make its way up the in between the braids of the piece of string, if you can imagine that. And there was some question as to whether or not it increased a woman's chance for getting an infection. Now, most experts that work in the field of contraception felt that, in fact, it's not the IUD that causes an infection, but it's acquiring an infection like a sexually transmitted disease that produces the initial problem. And that if you didn't acquire a sexually transmitted disease, you were not going to have a problem with infection. And most research to date has borne that out with IUDs. So IUDs have gradually gotten reintroduced to the American market. We've taken the Dalcon Shield off the American market, primarily because of the string issue, and it'll probably never make it back. But the current IUD, which lasts for 10 years, had copper in it and probably also produced slightly heavier, crampier periods. And in part to address that specific issue, they developed a new progesterone-containing IUD, and it has levonorgestrel. And levonorgestrel is the same progesterone in many popular birth control pills like Levalin or Trilevalin or Overal or Low Overal or Nordad. And also, it's the same progesterone that's in the Norplant implantable contraceptive device. And we think that not only does the levonorgestrel that's in this IUD help prevent pregnancies, but it also is thought that this levonorgestrel will leak and thin out the lining of the uterus, and so periods will actually be lighter on this type of IUD, and particularly lighter than on other types of IUD, but they may, in fact, be lighter than they would be normally. So we're really looking forward to this as an alternative. And in some countries, they're already testing it in menopausal women, not for contraceptive use, but to allow women to have that little bit of local progesterone effect that we look for in menopausal treatments without having to take the progesterone, which one in five women in menopause can't stand taking at all. So it's a very interesting new alternative.
Well, very good. We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll welcome others as well around Champaign-Urbana. You can call us at 333-9455. And toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have a listener on line number four in Marcellus. Hello?
Hello. I just wanted to ask the doctor some things about, I'm almost 60 years old, and I've been off and on with the Triest and the progesterone as a troche, and you put it in the under your tongue or in the buckle of your cheek. And I was on 2.5 milligrams of that. And twice a day. Well, then I had some breakthrough bleeding, so I quit it and laid off for, you know, 3 or 4 months. Then I went back to my doctor, and first he said, well, you know, your mother didn't have any problems. There's no cancer in the family, blah, blah, and probably don't need it. Well, the next time I went, well, your ferrite blew, you know, that kind of build that you probably should be on it. So I started it again, and then I got on the Internet, and I found a Dr. Rubin that I was kind of looking over his things to say, and he said people with varicose veins should not take the estrogen and progesterone type thing. And I do have one leg that has not really terribly painful varicose veins, but they are varicose veins. I wondered your opinion of that, and then I wondered this stopping and starting of it. Nobody seems to be able to tell me what to do. I wondered if you could help.
Okay, well, you're asking a lot of complicated questions, and of course, we can't treat you over the telephone, so I don't know that we can get them all answered. But for our listeners who don't know, Triest is not a formulation that is available by prescription specifically, but it has to be something that is what's called compounded at a local pharmacy. Triest usually has in it estrone, which is the estrogen that menopausal women naturally have in their body only in very, very low concentrations. It also has estradiol, which is the estrogen that our own ovaries make prior to the time of menopause, and it usually has some estriol. And estriol is a placental estrogen used in many European research studies or many European hormone replacement therapies, and you can find information in research studies if you look at foreign research studies, but not typically American. So it's a combination, and also it sounds like the combination you said had some type of progesterone in it, and without knowing exactly the type of progesterone, I can't really say whether you're on a synthetic or a natural progesterone, but usually these combinations have something like the progesterone in it. And it's not something that I typically prescribe because you can't go to the pharmacist and say, show me a research study with, you know, several hundreds or even thousands of women on this medication and show me what percent will respond by bone density or what percent will have beneficial effects on their cholesterol. You just can't get the data on it that you can get on other kinds of medications. Now, there's good reason to believe that it would have similar effects to the other medication, but we can't get that same information. Now, in terms of varicose veins, we think that high doses of estrogen will cause an increase in slight increase in clotting factors. And people with deep vein thrombosis or history of deep vein clots should not be on these formulations. But really, women with superficial varicose veins, which most women who say, I know I have a varicose vein, they're looking at something on their leg, and it's probably superficial. Mm-hmm. And most women with superficial varicosities are allowed to be treated with estrogen replacement therapy. Now, in terms of starting and stopping estrogen therapy, this is fairly straightforward. You get benefit when you're on it. You get none when you're off. Mm-hmm. It takes a while for the benefit to go away, so that if you compared women who are on the therapy to women who have been on the therapy and quit, after you've been off the therapy for a certain period of time, and for some effects they wither away in months, and some effects they may take a year or two to wither away. But basically, once you've been off long enough, it's like you were never on it. Uh-huh. So that in order to get benefit, you have to continue taking the medication. Uh-huh. And what most women need to do is they need to sit down with their provider and establish what are you really at risk for and what are you not at risk for. For instance, we think that estrogen therapy provides some heart benefit, and we think that for a number of reasons, including animal studies, including retrospective look-back studies. But there are a number of recent studies that even question that. But aside from, even if we weren't going to look at the recent studies which question it, let's look, for instance, if a particular woman is at risk for heart disease. If she's at risk, and this might be somebody with who doesn't exercise, who has heart disease in her family, who has smoked in the past, things like that, she might get some heart benefit by taking estrogen therapy. On the other hand, if your family lives to 100, nobody has a heart attack, well, we can give you all the estrogen in the world, but we're not going to improve your heart. Uh-huh. It's just not going to be something we're going to be able to do. We can't just with estrogen therapy do better than a naturally low risk, particularly if you are in good shape and you exercise
right.
an hour a day.
I exercise a lot.
Right.
I don't smoke and I don't overly drink.
So you have to look in every category. Estrogen can reduce your chance of colon cancer. It can improve your gums. It can improve macular degeneration of the eye. It can improve vaginal dryness. It can, to some extent, improve bladder function. So there are many things that it can do. And if you're looking to get benefit in those categories, well, maybe estrogen's the solution. But if for whatever reason you don't want to get benefit with estrogen, then what you need to ask your physician is, okay, but what else can I do, for instance, to lower my risk of colon cancer if I'm not going to take estrogen? What else can I do to improve my bladder function if I'm not going to take estrogen? What else can I do to prevent osteoporosis if I'm not going to take estrogen? So you go through what you're attempting to accomplish with the estrogen, and if you're not going to be on the estrogen, then what else are you going to do? And then it's a matter of choices. What many physicians feel is that the estrogen is... it's so straightforward. Here, this one pill or some sort of combination. And I say one pill and lightly because there's hundreds of choices we've gotten. You know, you found one that isn't even on the typical list. Mm-hmm. But with that one set of treatments, so much gets accomplished. Whereas women who want to do menopause treatments naturally, they are very able to do so. And yet it takes a lot more work, takes a lot more research, but it sounds like you're a researcher. I can't comment on this Dr. Rubin's site. I'm not sure. I encourage my patients to stick with the big organizations. So like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology has its own website, and the AMA has its own website, and there are some huge organizations. I like to go to Medscape and Health Central and a few places like that. I even read WebMD, and I think when I read those articles, they reference well-known, respected researchers in the various areas of my field. So that's why I rely on those sites. Mm-hmm. But once you start getting to the some of the other sites, it's usually a mixed bag. Of course, I should probably say that about my own site, but of course, I think when I say it's pretty reliable. Yeah. But, you know, often it is a mixed bag. And if you're really not sure of the information you're getting, it's best to try these big sites. But some of these big sites cannot answer every little question.
Right.
So it's a little bit tough.
Yeah. And, you know, then the recent link that was just came out in the paper about the cancer, that they did put it on the cancer estrogen on the cancer watch list, was a concern, too, that, you know, they've decided to list it as a cancer. They didn't say a cause, but...
Well, a couple of issues. Number one is there are ways to get these unregulated dosages of estrogen therapy. And if you get into a situation where your balance of estrogen far exceeds your balance of progesterone, you're going to be at risk for uterine cancer, and nobody will disagree with that. There's also a known fact that women on estrogen therapy will have a higher rate of diagnosis of breast cancer. Now, whether or not that is a cause or an effect or a fact that these women are tending to get more mammograms, it's not known. But we also know that certain individuals seem to have a higher risk for certain diseases, particularly breast cancer, and those individuals may have to also be scrutinized much more carefully with extra medical studies and, in fact, maybe receive specialized treatments. So that I think that it's very important that patients know that this is a hormone, it has uses, but these are pharmacologic dosages that individuals are taking. And there are even products that you can buy. You can go into health food stores and buy topical products that contain these hormones. You can get your hormone levels up very, very high in your body. And if you're not aware that these higher levels can have cancer consequences and you're not getting the proper evaluations by a physician, you might be at risk. So I think that it's important that they let the public know.
How do you measure the estrogen level in your body? I mean, they just look at me and say, oh, you're fair, you're thin-boned, you know, and my bone density is very good. But how they just say, well, you should be on it. Well, how do you measure estrogen levels that are already naturally in my body? Is it a blood test?
Well, the answer is yes and no. When it comes to menopause, the answer is always maybe. Yes, you can certainly do a blood test. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that when you get to a certain age, your natural levels will go very, very low because most of your natural estrogen is produced by your ovary, which has long ceased functioning. And you know that by your menstrual periods and some of the other kinds of signs and symptoms of menopause. So that for most women, when they cross over into menopause, they don't need to know their natural blood level, because we know it because we've studied women. Now, once we give therapies, then again, we don't need to know the average woman's natural blood level on certain medicines because it's been well studied. Mm-hmm. But you may be taking a combination that is not well studied. Mm-hmm. And you, in fact, may be a patient that would need to know that when you're on this estrogen, you need to know your blood level. Now, it's not always a simple thing to figure out what that blood level is, because if you've just swallowed your pill an hour or two before, you may get a reading based on a spike in your blood level after taking. Well, you're not swallowing, you're putting it under your tongue. But you know, still, there's initial spike after hormone treatments, where, say, a patch user, their hormone levels are about the same, whether you measure it 8 o'clock in the morning or 2 in the afternoon, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Well, it's confusing because you want to, you know, do what's right for your body. And I'm really basically a very healthy person, and I'm a person who doesn't like to take pills. So I think that too is what causes me to start and stop, and then I get a little nervous about it. And somebody convinces me, oh well, maybe you should be doing it. And in my case, no one seems to really know, but I'm sort of a naturalist and feel if it's not broke, don't fix it, you know?
Well, you're like the average American woman, and probably somewhere between 1/4 and 1/3 of menopausal women are on hormone replacement therapy. So there's a huge group that never started to begin with or is not on them, and they're responding to some of the things that you're responding to. But we have to remember that it wasn't natural for us to live long lives into our 80s, 90s, 100. That's not natural. We're doing that because of modern medicine, and some of what we're attempting to accomplish with estrogen therapy is to address the concerns of the 80, 90, 100-year-old woman.
Right.
Whereas in cave times, we had the 15-year-olds, the 20-year-olds, and the 25-year-olds, and there were a whole lot of people much older than that. It was completely different physiology that we're trying to treat.
Maintain and have a good, healthy lifestyle at those ages.
Right. It was a little bit naturaler to succumb earlier. So that's where that naturalist problem kind of comes in. But I think the good news is there are so many alternatives and there is so much information known. It is confusing, and that's why it's so important to help educate yourself. And it's so important to find the right healthcare provider that thinks along the lines that you do and is willing to listen to the information that you're bringing off the internet or wherever you're finding it, and try to sort it out for you.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that, Doctor, and thanks. It's helped clarify some things. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Great set of questions. We have another listener waiting, and we'll go to them. We're past our midpoint with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist, clinical professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and we're taking your questions on women's health. We have one person waiting and would welcome others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener north of Effingham on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I would like to ask Dr. Troopin this question. My father had prostate cancer, and they gave him estrogen. And I was just wondering, there other benefits for other kinds of types of cancer for use of estrogen?
As far as I know, that's one of the only actual cancers that has been treated by estrogen. I don't keep up in that field very much, and I don't even know how common a treatment it is. Now, as cancer therapies go, we do use some of the so-called designer estrogens like tamoxifen, and tamoxifen is a anti-estrogen with estrogenic properties. It binds to the estrogen receptor, does not act like estrogen in every tissue, but it acts like estrogen in some tissues. And specifically with tamoxifen, it acts as an anti-estrogen in the breast, so it's a breast cancer treatment. But it unfortunately acts like an estrogen on the lining of the uterus, and a few lining cancers of the uterus have been grown with tamoxifen use while we were treating the breast cancer. So, in women, it's not something that's typically used. Straight estrogen's not something that's typically used as a cancer therapy. But
okay,
good question.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, we have plenty of time to talk about some other issues. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, I noted that one of the areas of your interests are sports nutrition. And I was sitting around eating holiday food thinking, gee, I'd like to, I need to get to the gym or, after this especially. But is this one of the, it's noted on your website, that's one of your interests. We haven't really talked about that much on the show, but.
Well, I'm a consultant with eFit.com, yeah. So they're very interested in nutrition and particularly young women and athletes and what might be the right balance for them, because if they exercise so much that they stop cycling, they might run risk of osteoporosis. And so these are the kinds of things that I help them look into. Over the years, I collaborated on some research on the benefits of soy, not so much for athletes, but for all types of individuals, but certainly for vegetarians. Soy protein is so important, and we think that soy also has isoflavones, which are estrogens. And we think that those isoflavones, in fact, may have some benefit in preserving bone density as well. So those are the kinds of things that I've looked into. I think that one of the greatest uses of the internet in this day and age is to go to some of these bigger sites that deal with nutrition. If you like alternative medicine, I think Dr. Weil's site is. I never know how to pronounce his name. I've only seen it written. I've never met it, but I think it's W-E-I-L.
Right, Andrew
Weil. I think it's Dr. Weil. It's like D-R-W-I-E-I-L is his site. His site's good for alternative. Health Central also has a My Nutrition column. eFit.com, which has been rated as one of the top fitness websites. These things have places to go where you can put in information about your daily intake of nutrients, and you can get back information on areas that you should be concentrating on. And I've done it myself for my own diet on various websites to see what they say. Usually I'm like many other adults. I know when I'm good and I know when I'm bad, but I think that it's really helpful, because many individuals, when they were brought up, were not really taught cooking from the standpoint of nutrition, and they really weren't taught food labels, because there weren't the good food labels when we were growing up and learning how to cook and being young adults. And I think now there's so much good information. Of course, if you just grab some lettuce and put it in a cellophane bag and go running off, you're not going to get any food nutrition label with that. But if you look in the produce sections, grocery stores can provide you with food labels, even for things that don't appear to be labeled. And it's so important. I try to teach young adults to think about their fat percentages. And, of course, for athletes, it's always a question mark. Mm-hmm. My kids are involved in swimming, and their swimming coach was involved with the national team training camp in Colorado Springs. And once again, they're back to saying a half an hour after exercise, consume a lot extra carbohydrates. So, they're back to some of that carbohydrate loading question that seems to surface about every 5 years. And it's one of those areas of medicine that it. You can get information on both sides. So Those are the kinds of information. But so when you go, and even if you're getting something simple like spaghetti sauce, if you look at the labels, it's dramatically different in caloric content and fat percentage content from one brand to the next. And it's very informative to learn to consistently look at the labels and look at portion control. In the United States, that's the number one food crime is portion control. And really, most of us could eat pretty much anything we would want to eat, including desserts, including things like pastas and so forth, as long as we learn what an actual portion is. Same with things like potatoes, the big potatoes that we tend to buy in the grocery store. Probably are two or three portions worth of potatoes, not one. And those are the kinds of things that are fairly simple.
We have another call to talk with, and I may ask some more questions about that, but we'll defer to listeners. This is someone on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. My wife is a breast cancer survivor. She contracted it 18 years ago. And she was only like 38 years old when she got it. What I'm wondering is, what's the risk of breast cancer for my daughter? My daughter is currently 25, and I don't know whether she should start going in for annual mammograms.
Well, there's been a number of research studies that have tackled this, and we're getting a lot of static.
Yeah, I'll put the caller on hold for now, and I'll come back to you if you have a follow-up.
All right, I'm going to get off and just listen.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, so for those who couldn't quite hear the question, a gentleman was asking about his wife who had breast cancer at age 38, and what's the risk in his daughters. There's a good website, the National Cancer Institute, that allows you to calculate what's called the Gale scale risk, and it doesn't take into consideration every single risk factor, but there are these calculations. The makers of tamoxifen, which is brand name drug, I think Nolvadex, also has a website where they allow you to figure out your own risk. And most primary care physicians or obstetricians, gynecologists can help you figure out your risk based on a number of factors. And breast cancer in a mom or a sister is one of the most important factors that we do consider. Now, we think that the risk in the United States population is 1 in 8, and without knowing more about the individual family or the individual family genetic makeup, it's hard to know exactly how much higher that your risk might be, whether it was double or triple, which it can go up or it can go up much less percent. Only a small percentage of cancers are actually due to inherited factors. If your wife's family has one of these inherited factors, then the risk in family members goes up very dramatically. And the inherited factors that we know about that we're most concerned with are breast cancer genes 1 and 2. And these are available to be tested for by blood testing, but they're not widely available. And many obstetrician gynecologists and many primary care physicians would have no idea on how to get this test or whether you should get this test. And it's still in the controversial stage in terms of the average physician office. The best way to probably pursue it for an individual family is to first get what we call a genetic pedigree. And what they do is they do a 3-generation analysis if you know the family history of all your generations. And they look for clues in other organ systems so that not just breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancers, and certain other familial syndromes they look at. And if you have a sprinkling of these throughout your family, you're very likely carriers of one of these genes and might want to be tested for it. And probably the best way to get that testing is to go to a geneticist. I over the years, have sent my patients down to St. Louis to Barnes Hospital, and they don't need every single family member present, but they need access to these other family members' blood. Unfortunately, there are many variants of these genes, hundreds of variants, and even the test that they do doesn't test for every single variant. So the tests have some problems. And you need to sit down with an expert and really figure out whether this is something for you or not. Now, you also, so number one, okay, so that is how you sort of approach the family in general for carrying genetic risk factors. The next is a more practical question. What does a daughter do? And most of us recommend starting mammograms around age 30, and you said your daughter was 25, so that would be a little bit young. One of the problems with mammograms is that they're more accurate as individuals get older. Doesn't mean they're not accurate at all at younger ages, but they're less accurate. So that the longer you wait to start, you get a little bit more accuracy, and I think that's why we've targeted age 30. Now, if the mom had had breast cancer at age 25, yes, we would say a daughter should also have a mammogram at age 25. But since it was at age 38, starting mammograms at age 30 is probably going to be what most physicians would recommend. And then there's also the issue of if you have a slightly greater risk, would you be somebody that should take tamoxifen at some point in time? Again, not something we usually start around age 25, but closer to age 35 is approximately when you would start the tamoxifen. And then getting to the question you didn't ask, they thought you were going to ask, is estrogen treatment ever okay for someone who's had breast cancer that long in the past? And the new information is that many cancer specialists, gynecologic oncologists, are saying that some women can safely take hormone therapy when they get a number of years past their breast cancer. But it's such a complex topic. That's something that you really have to sit down with your own cancer specialist and go through the information on.
Hope that helps. Just one quick follow-up, and then we'll get to another caller. Is there intergenerational age correlation? That is, when a mother has had cancer at age 38 or 40, is it more likely that the daughter, if she's going to experience the same thing, would have it at about that same age?
Well, we don't know it that specifically, but it's more if the breast cancer was after menopause or before menopause. And before menopause, it's a little bit more likely that family members will also have the disease. Whereas after menopause, it tends to be something that was more likely the effects that the rest of us are all exposed to. And we think that there's something about our diet or our lifestyle or a combination thereof that predisposes us to breast cancer, because individuals who come from societies where breast cancer is very, very low, for instance, Japan, they come over, live in the United States, they get the same 1 in 8 risk that the rest of the American women are subjected to. So we definitely think it's something about being in the United States, and we mostly blame diet.
Very good. We have a couple callers waiting. We have about 5 minutes left. We'll try to get them both in. Next listener in Aurora on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. Good morning. Wanted to know, what can you tell me about pancreatitis, and is it more prevalent in women?
I can't tell you too much about pancreatitis. It's basically an inflammation of the pancreas, and it can be due to a variety of causes, from infectious up to a toxic kind of condition that is secondary to either gallbladder disease or liver disease. For instance, overconsumption of alcohol can lead to conditions of pancreatitis. And I think that gallbladder disease is more common in women, and therefore secondary pancreatitis due to gallbladder disease would probably be more common in women. But I think of the viral kinds of pancreatitis that there wouldn't be a sex difference. But that's about the limit of my information.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. We'll get to another caller here on line number 1, also from Aurora. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I was wondering if the doctor could have any information on Femara, which is an estrogen that they also give for breast cancer, and how it compares to tamoxifen.
Can you spell it?
F-E-M-A-R-A.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with that one, so I don't think I can comment.
How long is tamoxifen considered to still be in experimental stages? Because I know this Samira is kind of in an experimental stage.
No, tamoxifen is fairly well established. There have been a number of studies, and tamoxifen as a breast cancer treatment has been used for years and years and years, but now as a prevention treatment in the general population is something that was only released in about the past year, year and a half. But it was based on the a breast cancer trial that was done by the National Cancer Institute. Now, there is a new trial comparing tamoxifen to raloxifen, also a similar kind of medicine that is used as a menopause treatment and as an alternative to standard estrogen therapy. And we think that raloxifen not only helps prevent osteoporosis, but it also may prevent breast cancer, and some of the early information is that it may help prevent breast cancer more effectively than tamoxifen. So those two drugs are now being tested in a clinical trial called the STAR trial, where they're comparing those two. So even though tamoxifen has moved in certain treatment sectors, like many drugs, past the so-called experimental stage, there's still more to be known and more research that is being done.
When women go on those, do they keep a are they automatically entered into the study, or is only?
No. Most research studies you have to specifically sign up for. Research studies are very rigorously controlled in the United States, so that they are initially reviewed by investigational review board, and then they have a specific consent process, meaning that the patient's evaluated to whether she is eligible or is not eligible, and then she has to read a specific consent form. And part of that consent process has to involve telling her what her alternative therapies are that would either do or maybe approximately do what she is going to try to accomplish by being in the research study. So you have to specifically sign up for a research study and then be followed. Now, there are what's called retrospective studies, so that certain particularly large institutions have certain amount of information, and they may do what's called a look-back study. So let's say they were interested in tamoxifen patients. They may choose just to pull all their tamoxifen charts off the shelf from the past 5 years and see if anybody got diagnosed with a particular kind of condition, say high blood pressure or a headache or whatever they happen to be interested in studying. And those look-back studies, the individual patients do not have to consent for, other than that it's her own doctors who she knew would have access to that information. But just any old researcher can't have access to your chart.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. And we're at the end of our time, so we're going to have to stop.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much to you. And I also wanted to mention your website, because I was looking at it this morning, and it's really good.
Well, I have a couple of websites. And my basic website at womenshealthpractice.com I've actually had for about 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to make it a little bit more user-friendly with more modern technologies. But I also have one that is under the Medem site, and it's womenshealthpractice.medem, which is spelled MEDEM.com. And under that site, I have some daily news hookups with some of the major organizations like the AMA and so forth. So I'm trying to get some information out there. I know patients are looking, and I think it's important for physicians to help them look in the right place.
Well, very good. Our guest has been Dr. Suzanne Troopin, again with us once a month, normally on the fourth Monday. Today's special case. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. Suzanne, thanks again.
Thank you.